6th chapter, verse 15. We'll have her reading first. Sister Gail, if you'd read through 19.
When Jesus therefore perceived that they would come and take him by force to make him a king, he departed again into a mountain himself alone. And when even was now come, his disciples went down unto the sea and entered into a ship and went over the sea toward Capernaum. And it was now dark, and Jesus was not come to them. And the sea arose by reason of a great wind that blew. So when they had rowed about 25 or 30 furlongs, they see Jesus walking on the sea and drawing nigh unto the ship, and they were afraid.
All right, now back to verse 15. When Jesus therefore perceived that they would come and take him by force to make him a king, he departed again into a mountain himself alone. Where is this scene? Where is he now when he goes to this mountain? Where was he?
Bethsaida?
Well, it was the wilderness of Bethsaida, but of course it just said that there was a plain where it was grassy and so forth. The site that this is taking place is where the feeding of the multitude took place. He had fed the multitude. Remember the 5,000. Now, they finished, they were all full. Now he decides. He could see the multitude was beginning to say, well, this is some miracle that's just been performed, and is not like this the Messiah, or something along that line their conversation was, and he could see the gist of it. And here it says that he could see the drift of the conversation was that they wanted to start a movement to precipitate him becoming a king. It says here, when that they would come and take him by force and proclaim him as king. In other words, they go down to Jerusalem. They were going to go down anyway because of Passover. That's right. So this would just fit in beautifully with their plan. And Jesus wanted to circumvent that. Now, the thing that's unusual is that he went up into the mountain himself alone. Now, what about the disciples?
The other gospels show that he instructed them to get into the ship and start to head across the sea.
Yes, he had to really reason with them pretty strongly because they didn't like the idea of him going up in the mountain and they going on the sea. But that was the instructions he left in the other gospels. Now, the mountain can almost be guessed as to which mountain was involved. And there's a picture that's in some of the religious publications that picture this, I think, correctly, even the backdrop, and which we'll now consider as we go along. So he's up in a mountain, and they're now on the sea. And a wind arises, and that probably arose from Mount Hermon, which is north, comes down between the Anti-Lebanon Mountains like a funnel and blows on the sea, which is known as being very treacherous when this wind comes up. Now they're rowing to another destination. Where are they rowing to?
Capernaum.
So they are on the other side of the sea, opposite Capernaum, but not necessarily east-west opposite. It can be a diagonal, and it probably was a diagonal for other reasons, which we'll soon begin to examine. Now, he's up in the mountain. They're rowing on the sea. And verse 19 tells us that they had rowed about 25 or 30 furlongs. So John is not, he didn't have a measuring tape, so he's just giving an approximation where they were, and which would be roughly, all right, it would be probably 3 miles, very, very close. Another thing, the Roman mile and our mile are a little different. Ours is 5,280 feet to a mile, our, what we call, and we think of that as an English mile based on the Roman, but actually the Roman is a little less. The Roman mile is less than our mile today. So you have to make the adjustment accordingly. So it's between 25 and 30, roughly 3 miles. Now, when they rode 3 miles, based on the other account, they were at what point on the sea?
About midpoint. And wouldn't this mean that they would have to go on the diagonal, otherwise they would have been across the
sea? Yeah, well, you see, we're talking now about the north end of the lake. And from that plain to Capernaum, not the ruins of Peter's house. You know, when we go over there several times, there are these ruins up there, which they call that this is Capernaum and so forth. But actually, Capernaum would be slightly more to the left of that. That would be Capernaum, but a suburb.
Would be near that church?
A little more to the left, if you're looking at it.
Towards Magdala?
It's towards Magdala. In other words, probably Magdala and Capernaum almost bordered one another when they were occupied. Now there's no city there anymore. So they're at the midpoint, 3 miles out, 3 miles to go. They've only gotten halfway across. And now they're rowing like... Yes, it's over 6 hours. It's almost about 9 hours they're rowing. That's a long time to go the distance that they would normally go. So they're out in a storm, and they're determined to go to Capernaum, but the wind is blowing opposite them. So they're heading in a somewhat north direction because the wind is holding them back, and that's exactly the traditional way the wind blows. From the north to the south, that makes that treacherous, Sea of Galilee so treacherous. And if you've been there and seen that grassy plain, and then figure about Capernaum, that is just a little left of that church that's down near the water, it'd be a diagonal across the lake, northerly, not due north, but pretty much north. And now they're at the halfway point. Now, what else about this night? The wind is blowing. What else?
It's very dark.
All right. It's at the dark part of the night. When did they leave?
Sunset.
Beginning of the day. Jewish Doma, Jewish Day.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was just beginning to get dark, and they're going. And, of course, they go by sight, right? When you go at night, you don't want to row in the pitch darkness. So they would go towards evening. It would be very late afternoon. And they would make an allowance of time that, well, we should get over there in plenty of time, and say an hour and a half. Plenty of time. But they did not anticipate this wind. So they leave while it's still light, but it's late in the day. And then darkness comes because it's not until the middle of the wee hours of the morning, around 3 o'clock in the morning, before the Savior intercepts them. That's a long time to be rowing, and they're only halfway. They're at the point of no return. Now, this tells us another thing, that it tells us, of course, that Jesus saw them. This suggests another thought. That what? Incidentally, the mountain that Brother Paul Balco and I climbed, beautiful view of that whole sea, the whole sea up in that park. And that's the mountain I think he was at, because it borders, it's right next to this plain, but on the other side of the road. And it tells us then, we believe, that it was moonlight. It was a moonlight night. Now, Jesus could have x-ray eyes, and he could see them, but it isn't necessary, because they saw him walking on the road. On the road. It was a road at the time he walked on it, on the sea. But it suggests that while it was in the pitch black darkness of night, the moon was shining, so that they could see him approaching. And this artist's conception has this very mount that we climbed, and it has the moon shining like a path on the sea, which happens if you're near water. I used to be near the ocean. I used to swim in the moonlight out towards the sound and follow that light like a path right on the water from the moonlight. And so this artist has the moon back of Jesus making like a road on the sea near their boat, and you can see him approaching like a silhouette. Approaching, disheartened. I think it's just terrific, that picture. Many people think, well, that's a beautiful picture, and it's very dramatic, but it has the actual scenery. It has the actual scenery of the lake, the silhouette of that particular mountain, too. So they see him approaching, so it's moonlight. And he's walking on the sea, drawing nigh unto the ship. And they were afraid. Now let's read verse 20 through 20 and 21.
But he saith unto them, It is I, be not afraid. Then they willingly received him into the ship, and immediately the ship was at the land whither they went.
Now, John tries not to be repetitive, because the other Gospels give enough information of what happened on this occasion. And he just does not repeat all the other things the others said. But he brings in new information, which the others did not bring in. So John, writing the Gospel, he's the last Gospel writer. And I believe the Gospels were written in the sequence that they're shown. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. Modern Bible scholars say, oh no, it isn't that way at all. And they'll agree with maybe John being the last, yes, but not the others. But we feel there's plenty of evidence to have it just the way it is, that we find it in the Bible. Now, it says, when he said to them, what?
It is I.
Be not afraid. It is I. Be not afraid. Now, what does that tell us?
That they were a little bit afraid.
Oh, yeah.
They thought he was a spirit being.
Right. That was one thing. They thought they were seeing certainly something supernatural from their concept, looking.
Walking on water.
Incidentally, the Egyptian hieroglyph of that which is a miracle or impossible is a foot on choppy water. That's a hieroglyph that they show. And when he mentioned, be not afraid, it is I, this is characteristic of Jesus, this type of language. So it probably had an intonation of his personality. You know, different people say different things in different ways. In his saying this, there would be a feeling of strength in what he was saying. And they would recognize, and then it says, then they willingly received him into the boat when he made that statement. But of course, the other accounts show that he made as though he's going to walk right by them at first. John doesn't mention that because that's covered by the other gospels. And then they cried out for fear and so forth, and then Peter was involved. Sinking in the sea and so forth. John could have easily brought that up, but he's wanting to bring up another thought, which is just as radical. Now, then they willingly received him into the ship. And it's this, yes.
Before you go to the next thought, I was thinking, it seems kind of appropriate that, I was just looking at the concordance, Capernaum means village of Nahum, and then Nahum means comforter. And that seems to fit nicely with where Jesus says, it is I, be not afraid. That idea of being a comforter to them.
Very good. Then the last part of that verse is,
immediately
the ship was at land. Now, the others overlooked this. This is again where John, the others could see him walking on the water and all, but he has to have something in the narrative so we know what he's talking about, John. But notice how simply he doesn't go into all the details. He's up in the mountain, he sees them rowing, and they've gone about this distance, 3 miles, out into the sea. They still haven't gotten to their destination. And then Jesus is walking on the water to them. Very brief, just a few verses. And John noticed that when he stepped into the boat, the next thing, they were pulling into land. Where, comparing the other accounts, they're in the middle of the sea. Now, they're there. And so this would show several things. One is, what does this accentuate? This is a miracle.
Controlling elements?
One thing, the control of the elements. That he even showed when he could walk on the water. Yes?
I always thought that the sea had represented our life and that the disciples were now apart from him. And the wind with Satan being the prince of the wind was the thing that they were fighting against. And that once Christ came to us.
Yep. Anything, a lot of comments on this.
About the Psalm 46, be still? Is something?
Well, though the mountains be cast in the midst of the sea, yet will we not be afraid, and so forth. He's the one that's dwelling in the secret place. Yes.
I know what we talked about earlier, the idea of being changed in the moment, the twinkling of an eye. That's might have an antithetical fulfillment in terms of the church's salvation.
Yes, it has an antithetical fulfillment. Both accounts, the one where he's asleep in the boat, as well as this one. Yes.
Also, they see Jesus. It says they see Jesus, but it doesn't say they recognize Jesus. They didn't recognize him until he said. So it could also be the fight of the seeing a silhouette of the false Christ or whatever, and not recognizing him until he came, and then they recognized him when he spoke. In other words, it would be they weren't sure.
Well, they thought it was an apparition, like a ghost light.
I'm getting back to Alan.
See what they heard, not what they saw. Whenever they heard what he had to say, not how he looked.
Brother Franklin, were the during the trial of the believers and feel the comfort, God, the Lord being with them, and then feel peace.
Well, we'll come to that. We'll try to sum up some of the thoughts that have been stated, plus a couple other. Notice that it's like when the Lord deals with his people. He allowed them to struggle those 9 hours without intervening. And these are strong men. And these boats are not canoes. They're fishing boats. They're boats that are cumbersome. But these men can row fast in them with their oars when you have several strong men on the oars. You can go pretty fast, but nevertheless, it's taxing. Now, this wind arising, and they're bucking this wind, and they're not getting any place, and rowing all that time. Because had they not rowed, what would have happened? The boat would have started turning around, maybe tipping. You have to keep the bow in the wind a certain way so that it doesn't get too tippy and capsize. So they have to calculate the direction of the wind and the nature of their rowing to point to the destination they want to go. And he waits all that time and then comes to them so late. And they've been struggling. And they're just as far away from both shores. And then he comes and just steps in the boat, and the boat is at their destination. It's not merely shown to them. It means that with his presence and with his assistance, all obstacles can be overcome. But it's a good lesson and a very helpful lesson, and they probably will appreciate that, those that have done that, in the past, when they look back in that account. If you were one of those doing all these things, and then you later had this experience where the Lord stepped in the boat, and then the boat is at land, you'd appreciate all your efforts. But many people think differently, as has been suggested, based on background. They overlooked the others, that the boat immediately came to land. What the others would see is that when he stepped in the boat, it was calm. He controlled that everything was in order, and they would get the lesson, but not quite as strong as John. John noticed not only what all the others noticed, he noticed in addition that it was at shore, showing that with his grace and help. Now, there's other things. The time, well, of course, the time is not here, is it? Let's go to one of the other Gospels. Let's see.
Matthew has the
watch
and looking watch.
Yeah, that's right.
Matthew 14:25.
All right, now, in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went unto them walking on the sea. All right, what's the first watch?
6 to 9.
All right, 6 to 9 in the evening. Second watch? Third watch?
Midnight, 3 a.m.
And then the fourth watch?
3 a.m.
So it's in the last watch of the night before dawn. And it doesn't specify what hour, but it's in that fourth watch that he comes. Now we know that they've been rowing at least 9 hours. At least. Plus, we don't know how much plus. That gives you some concept of the ordeal they went through. This reminds you of something else, yes?
Is there any numerical significance to the fourth?
Well, that's what we're coming to next. Do you recall any other statements about the watch? Maybe in the concordance you can look at it, and I think it may be in Matthew too, under the term watch. If he come in the such and such watch, or such and such watch. It's in Matthew or Luke. All right, that's part of it. But that's part of it. Go on.
That's Matthew 24:43.
All right, now let's look at that one. I don't know if that's the one or not, but there's more information.
Luke 38.
Right. that Matthew 24 is when?
24:33.
All right.
Oh, I think you
want
12.
23. 23. Yeah. All right, that's on another subject. That isn't the one.
Luke 12:38.
All right, it's the Luke account. Because Luke and Matthew both speak, but in a different sense. All right, would you read, please? Just to comprehend what.
Blessed are those servants whom the Lord, when he cometh, shall find watching. Verily I say unto you that he shall gird himself and make them sit down to meat, and will come forth and serve them. And if he shall come in the second watch or in the third watch and find them so, blessed are those servants.
What verses were those then?
12:38. And then it has about the thief. Good man,
yeah. What this second and third? What verses were there?
Verse 37, 38, 12, 38.
It's in 38. Yeah, that's I couldn't find it in the other. But he doesn't tell them when he's coming. And if he shall come in the second watch. So he mentions the various watches.
But then the next verse applies the watch would not be known ahead of time.
Right.
The good man, Satan, so it probably
right.
wouldn't be the second or third by implication.
Right.
It would be the fourth.
It's the fourth by implication. Or I figured that the end of the third introducing the fourth. See what I mean? If it's at 3 o'clock, from one standpoint, 3 o'clock is the end of the third watch, but it's the beginning of the fourth watch. And this would then be, there's different comings in the Bible. One is the presence of our Lord as an invisible being was in 1874. October. But no one knew at that time that he was present until he knocked at the door. And in the Matthew account and the Luke account, it gives the impression that he was here before the servant served the meat in due season. Because he says, if he shall find that servant, so forth, doing that, blessed is that servant, because the Lord would use him to furnish things new and old for God's people, that he would use this servant to do. And that had to do with the first watch, as it were, that he was present and had been present before that food was dispensed. And then, of course, there was anticipation that the change of the church would take place, let us say, 1914. But that's what that's what the whole ministry of Present Truth was. That in the fall of 1914, that would be the end of the age. And certainly, that if the church is to go before the trouble, that sometime before 1914, 1 year, 3 years, 7 years, there were different views at that time, but all predicated on that 14 date, that the church would be gone before that. Sometime before that, but in proximity to it. So here's another watch, as it were, that they were anticipating. And that proved to be not the case, because while the date 1914 is very important, it had other connotations than the one that the brethren were expecting at that time. So he's saying that it's blessed to be in that waiting attitude, but if your expectation of him coming to take you home, see, there's different types of coming. One is where he comes to feed his people at the harvest time. That's a coming. But there are different types of coming. And it's this third watch at the end, but he calls it here, in the fourth watch, he comes to them. In the fourth watch, he cometh unto them, walking upon the sea, so forth. And so this would show that there would be these prior disappointments. But they all had to occur before sunrise. Because the fourth end of the fourth watch is sunrise. The end of it. So this is like right at the, you're coming right down to the end. So therefore, this is telling us, we believe that this is a prophetic vision. That what happened back there has a spiritual, or that has a typical significance. And that it's down here when the waves and the wind are blowing. Yes?
Then are you saying when Jesus went into the mountain and sent the disciples away, that was the first advent? And then walking on the water is the...
No, I'm not trying to... Because this in Luke just says that there are different watches. I'm not tying those in with the account that we're reading today in John. But the John account is only saying that he came unto them walking on the sea, and they saw it. But reading the Matthew account, it tells us it was in the fourth hour, fourth watch, that he came to them. So by piecing it together, we see the time element. But nothing is mentioned in the count of the third, second, and first at all there. The only thing is that was of interest is that at even the disciples did get in the boat and leave. And if that was 6 o'clock, then that would be the first watch from that standpoint. But then what would be the second watch? If you're going to apply it to this parable, the only thing, it's so sketchy, it'd be when he looked from the mountain and saw them struggling on the sea. And then the next thing is when he came to them on the sea, because he was up on the mountain, so he had to go down that mountain and then transit the plain. And if you look at those distances, that's going to take a little time to accomplish that.
So that going up to the mountain would be like ascending to the heaven after resurrection?
Yeah. That would be the instantaneous change that we mentioned before. And then if you take what's, it's like fragments of this have been expressed one by one, one or the other. When you say the Capernaum, somebody, who was it mentioned that, that like a haven of rest, see? And if you consider that as our heavenly Canaan, there remaineth a rest for the people of God. And that this rest is the change. That blessed are those who that they'll rest from their labors and their works do follow. This is a scripture that applies now at this time of the age. So if you think of it from that standpoint, the boat and the wind rising and that the manifestation of Christ's presence, not just in the theoretical sense, but in the realistic sense, where he steps in the boat, as it were, and then you're at the haven, would seem to suggest this is the very end of the age, as far as back there it was the apostles, as the heel members or the last members of the body of Christ are concerned. This is the, and this would be a collective rescue, which we've been saying, that the there'll be no last individual member of the little flock, but a group of members. Elijah, when he was taken up into heaven, was an individual. But what he pictured was not an individual. It pictured the church at the very end, caught up in the chariot of fire. So Elijah, one, is really a symbol of several, the last members of the little flock. But in this case, you have several apostles in a boat. And when he comes to them and the boat is at land, it's a group picture. In other words, the class that are at the very end of the age that receive their change will be a a collective place, not an individual.
Is there any analogy like between a Noah's ark and UPS, like they're in a boat, the little ark, it could be, and then comes the...
Well, there are the three that entered primarily because the wives are not considered in the prophetic aspect, normally speaking. There was Noah, who would be a representation of Christ, and Shem, Ham, and Japheth would be the little flock class in that particular picture. Just like there was the three Hebrew children cast into the lake, into the furnace. The last members of the church will be dealt with not as one individual, but as a group. Gideon, when he fought that battle against the Midianites, there were 300. Three 100s. Three in the furnace of fire affliction at the end of the... All these are Pastor Russell pictures in his volumes and in the reprint. But what he never did was put them all together. He explained this one, explained that one in great detail. But when we put it together, it's a shocker. It shows then why we're given like a tremendous wealth of information. So you had the three in the boat, Noah's Ark, the three primary sons, and the three in the furnace, and the three with the Gideon, and so showing that it's not a single individual, it's a group, the last member. And so we say the heel, that the heel is stung by the adversary in the Garden of Eden. It pictures this serpent seed and the Messiah seed. But the heel members are to be bruised. Not one member, but the heel members of the body of Christ. So you have a tremendous amount of information. Tremendous. Of which this boat incident fits into the picture. Yes?
I think in Noah's ark, you're not counting them Noah. You're just counting the son.
No, Noah's represents Jesus. Yes.
Is there any, like we were talking about the moon before, like Jesus, when he died, the full moon, right, at that Passover, which typified the fullness of the law covenant. Is there any, maybe...
Well, I feel that the first Passover and the last Passover will correspond with the calendar in every respect. We know that, numerically speaking, when it speaks of the month of Abib, the 10th day of the month, the lamb is taken, the 14th day it's slain, and it's eaten in the type, the 15th day, and then on that morrow, the same day, they exited it from Egypt. Now, that also occurred, we believe, not only numerically, according to the way it's laid down, and we numerically observe it here, but it will correspond with the day of the week. For instance, when Jesus died, that was on a Friday, which was the 14th of Nisan. The 16th of Nisan was the waving of the sheaf offering. That corresponds to Sunday, that he was risen from the dead on Sunday. So you have Friday he died, Sunday he was risen. One is the 14th of Nisan, one is the 16th of Nisan. Well, but that Nisan, that in the Jewish calculation must take place. Like, for instance, the 25th of December is Christmas, whatever day of the week it falls on. But we believe that it fell on when Jesus died the Friday and was risen Sunday, that it corresponded in the original Passover that way, both numerically as well as the day of the week. And now at the end of the age, we wouldn't be surprised that it might be exactly the same way.
That one reason why then we could work the Jubilee cycles in too, because it has to start like a new arrangement.
Yeah, well,
maybe I'm going
to... Yeah, well, you could work it in, but that is a mighty big... oh my goodness. That's a big subject. Yes, but look, when Satan attacked Israel, It was on their Day of Atonement. See what I mean? He knew that when the city was destroyed in A.D. 69, they knew that the people go to that feast. And so there were millions of Jews collected together to observe the Day of Atonement, which is followed by the Feast of Tabernacles. And it's then that the Roman army encircled the city, because that strategically was the best day to do it. When they were religiously occupied on what they felt was such a holy day, it was propitious that the attack would be at that time. And so he established a cordon or a net around the city. And then, of course, it took them a few years to subjugate the city. But nevertheless, that's when the net was drawn. You had the Yom Kippur War. Strategically, when they were going to observe the first Yom Kippur, Israel makes a great deal to do with that, as well as the Day of Atonement. And that's when the Arabs attacked Israel. It's strategically, and we feel that the adversary, in destroying the last members of the body, it may be that he chooses the Passover. We don't know to do that, whether he will or not. Yes?
The other correspondence I was wondering about was the, like in connection with the crucifixion of Jesus, the darkness was over the land from the sixth to the ninth hour. Whether that, like darkness, could correspond here in this picture.
Yeah, the ninth hour being 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Yeah. Which is the end of one watch, the beginning of another. Doesn't say when in that watch, but in the watch.
And then that would also, I think, it maybe correspond to like Adam, because the fall took place, and like the Kut speaks of him in the cool of the day, mm-hmm. being in the garden, which would be like the late afternoon. Whether that might also relate.
Well, I think of course they say hindsight is always better than foresight. In other words, when something is fulfilled and you look back on it, you can see with clearness history because it's fulfilled. And same here, I think that at the end of the age, when certain events occur, that when that has come and gone and you look back, there'll be probably very remarkable coincidences that were not observed in advance, but could be seen later. Well, he was commemorating the victory when he was.
He thought he won the war,
but yet at the end of the war,
he won that battle.
Yeah, he won a battle initially, but they're very silent on the fact that one third of the army was bottled up there near the Suez that could have been wiped out with ease. But they took the initial attack as a victory. The initial, where in the war, you figure war on the results. Not of a battle, but of the sum total. Did you win or did you lose? Yeah.
My thought was really to take advantage of them in their holy day.
Well, what I was hinting at, whether that if you wanted to get the brethren in one place or something to lock them up, let us say, a very convenient time would be at the memorial. Because that's many brethren who don't even attend to strictly meetings, they somehow seem to gravitate for that observance. Just like with the nominal system, it's Easter time. Remember that minister always laced into the people. Why do you come here at Easter time? Why? And Christmas time. He said, what about the other weeks of the year? So strategically, I think it would be done, it's the adversary knows the best time to do what he feels, make it with one stroke convenient. And I think under those circumstances, I think those who are fearful of mind and all would stay away on that occasion. And only those who are courageous at that time. And it's one thing to say it, and it's another thing to do it. like those who died at the stake and so forth. There's all room for compromise when the chips are down. Whether you or I will be faithful, that remains to be seen when the circumstances arise as to just what metal we really are of. Theoretically, it's, oh, that's easy, you know, we'll be glad to and so forth. But there are a lot of circumstances involved, not just maybe only you personally. Maybe your family is involved, your loved ones. There's all kinds of techniques the adversary used on saints of the past to make them compromise, if not them direct through their family, to get them to bend the knee, to bail, as it were. So I think at this time, under those circumstances, many brethren will have be fearful to congregate. Many who now meet under those circumstances might not do so. And of course, you could find all kinds of excuses why not. If we do it now today with health or some other reason, under that, it would seem to be very logical at that time and prudent. In any event, we think that that time element is important, and that that fourth watch is significant in that there and ties in with other pictures. I think we've gone way beyond the lesson now, and the time-wise, let's see,
we're not way beyond what we're about.
Can I just ask you about the order that Jesus walked around?
Sufficiently strong to hold the waves back so that they congealed. But, by frozen back there, that's what we feel in the Red Sea. Same principle happens here. You have wind and freezing. But the freezing is the path. And if the water is kept off of the ice, then it isn't slippery. See what I mean? Because you can walk on like a nice lake, and especially if it's a sort of a frosted freezing, it is no difficulty. I don't think he, as a human, did that. That was miraculously provided for.
That would explain why Peter felt he'd go out and meet him.
Maybe, I don't know, but I do think there must have been a moon for them to see. I could see how Jesus could miraculously look down on the sea, but that isn't necessary. But for the other round, I think the moon was shining on that particular night.
And then if Peter walked down and started to sink, is that like when the ice starts to get softened, it'll start to waver a little bit?
It had to do, of course, with faith.
Yes, but as his faith, as he reached out to Jesus, then it would solidify and he'd have that solid faith.
And then he cried out for the Lord to have mercy on him. Not here, but this is not in John. But that's another one. That's when he threw off all his clothes and then jumped in the sea to swim to meet the Master at his resurrection.
The thought that Alan brought out was the sea representing the word, world of mankind in general, and where we are.
Well, in this, I would not think it's the world of mankind in general. It's the trouble to the church. We have said that there are several times of trouble. The time of trouble is the world's trouble. But there's a time of trouble for the little flock, the last members. There's a time of trouble for the great company. There's a time of trouble for the nominal church when it's destroyed. So you have several times of trouble. But there, these...
Jacob's trouble.
Huh? Jacob's trouble, that's right. We list them all. There's several. But the time of trouble, it has to do with that which starts with the fall of the nominal system. Because that's a radical thing. When the nominal church is destroyed,
And then in that escape, the escapees are the great company class, among others, who are dealt with, who have their troubles. And then there comes Jacob's trouble at the end. But all of those are embracing a trouble subsequent to the church's trouble. And the church's trouble is a deliverance, is a wonderful experience, a privileged experience that such as have the faith at that time and exercise. Yes?
Frank, I thought when we were studying this account in Matthew, Matthew 14, that we had said that when the boat was in the midst of the sea, that represented the Christian being in the world, and that the tossing of the waves was the trials on the church.
Yes, we have said that, but that's approaching the subject from a completely different standpoint, moral lessons.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like Elijah. There was a time here among the brethren that they were given all talks on Elijah. Now, this is about 20, 30 years ago. There was a period there of about 15 years where I don't know how many talks I heard about Elijah. Not one of them prophetic, because they didn't believe, the brethren at that time, here in the East at least, that the church, nominal church, would ever come back into power. There's a radical change today. Now you have like maybe 60% one way and 40% the other way. But back there, you know, among the brethren who voiced their opinions, I only knew of two. I knew of only two individuals. And that's here in the East. That's not just this class here or New Brunswick or Jersey City, but that I personally knew only two people who believed it was future. The rise. But what happens, we're social. And if the leadership, some of them change in their thinking, well, then the others begin to change. And this is what happened. Not the original leaders, because they died with their view. Many of them back there, they're all off the scene. But what has happened, the next generation that's come, being closer to the volumes, has avoided that.
In other words,
this
could be a double picture.
Yeah, sure. Sure. When you go back and look at Jesus, what he did, his parables, several of them are dispensational parables. But they're parables of lessons of character as well. And you cannot, like, do it at the same time. You either have to study it from the one standpoint consistently through to get the full benefit, and then the other consistently through to get the other. But once you start trying to correlate them, you're losing then the perspective, because it really muddles the picture by trying to at the same time correlate them. They're not meant to be.
Somewhat like Moses and some of the pictures we have at the tabernacle, where you can represent Jesus in some, and then also.
He represents God, he represents the law, he represents Jesus, he represents the Christ, he represents the second death class, Moses, depending on what incident you're talking about and the circumstances. But this, with the water going in the boat, there's another, there were two cases, one with the sleeping in the stern of the boat with his head on a pillow, and the water coming in. But actually, that has also a dispensational account. And very often in some of these studies, we don't bring it up unless it comes up, depending on the questions. Like today, goodness knows, I never dreamed we'd spend so much time, you know, on this subject, but it just seems to be coming up that way. But we're getting nearer the end of the age, and so these things are timely to consider. Now, things have changed considerably from what they were 30 years ago along certain lines. And immediately the ship was at land. That's where we left off. Now, I think we have to end the study there, don't we? Just about, because the next... Well, let's see. How much time? I've got 10 minutes or 5 minutes?
Well, it's after 12:30 now.
We started late. We had to stay an hour.
All right, then we'll stop here. Because there's an interesting character lesson in when we come after this. Of the foible fickleness of man.